The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, it's a wide world of football, and like Gerard Depardieu, we whiz all over the place. From the Premier League, where Arsenal face Liverpool with bans and injuries mounting and Gunnasaurus set to debut at the back, to Spain, where the strike is on, but not before Barcelona meet Real Madrid and Mourinho gets involved in a touchline brawl, to Italy, where our special roundup of the scandals that matter includes the match drinks with sedatives in and a game of caucho that thus sent people to sleep literally. All of that, plus your tweets and posts and a bit of championship news as well, in today's Football Weekly Extra. And off we go then with another whirlwind tour of the crazy game of football. On board today, we have Owen Gibson, but Hello. Not for long, because you're headed for a press conference at QPR, Nest Park.
Exciting stuff indeed. They're going to unveil their new owners.
Oh, lovely. Okay. Literally, is there going to be a...
I'm hoping so. Scooby-Doo style unveiling.
Yeah. All right then. Barry Glendinning also here.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. And Sean Ingle.
Good news, I hear. You're back on domestic television for the first time since 2003.
Since 2003, is it? That's not strictly true, is it, Sean Ingle?
Isn't it?
No. It's not. If you're going to twist the knife, at least polish it and sharpen it properly.
The world's strongest man on Channel 5, I hear.
That's right, yeah. Yep.
You're presenting as
presenting, not competing. Yes. Thanks, Barry, for that clarification. That's true. But not for a while. Filming should take place in September. But lucky viewers might be able to see the results around Christmas time, I think. It might mean, though, that I'll have to miss a week of pod.
That's all right. We've already got Max Rushton lined up.
Have you?
Oh. A bit cold.
all right. Anyway, let's start off with the Premier League. And, Arsenal are playing Liverpool. Arsenal fresh from their triumph midweek over Udinese. A triumph which saw them record yet another clean sheet. Everything going better and better for Arsenal, really.
Couldn't be going better, could it? I mean, just look at the back pages. Although I don't think it's quite as bad a result as some people are making out. I mean, to fit into the Arsenal in crisis narrative, everyone had to make out that a 1-0 win at home to Udinese was a dreadful result, and actually still stand a pretty good chance of making it through, don't they?
Well, they're in the driving seat, and they will have Van Persie back for the return leg, which will be in Friuli, there in the northeastern corner of Italy. But Udinese a bit unlucky not to get the away goal. The Italian papers saying that this scoreline was as false as Monopoly money. Because they're not keen on fake scorelines in Italy.
I was going to say, they know a lot about fake scorelines and Monopoly money, probably, in Italy.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was a good result for Arsenal, but they were rather fortuitous not to concede. I think if Udinese had been a bit sharper, and, you know, obviously it was their first game of the season, then they might well have scored. But, yeah, but 1-0 win is fine.
Oh, yeah. They're a lovely bunch to watch, aren't they, Udinese?
Yeah, very nice. It was a good game.
Yeah.
But anything does play into all the obvious narratives about Arsenal, doesn't it, though, when you've got kind of, you know, untested young defenders on the pitch in a crucial Champions League qualifier and fairly threadbare other positions elsewhere on the pitch. And, you know, kind of everything everyone is saying is true, but I think there's a rush to turn a drama into a crisis.
But that said, though, against Liverpool, they're likely to be starting with Frimpong, with Oxlade-Chamberlain, with Jenkinson, all of whom I think of... between them, rather, have played about an hour of Premier League football. And if you're a side that, you know, has pretensions to, if not win the league, then certainly finish in the top three or four, that's hardly ideal. And I guess the other thing which really grates Arsenal fans, if you look at how much outlays they've had this season, Fabregas has gone, Clichy's gone, Ubue's gone, Bentner's expected to go.
Nasri
apparently is going to go today for about 25 million. I mean, that's about 77 million, and they've only brought in roughly 20-odd million pounds worth of players. So Arsene Wenger is sitting on what we must call a war chest of about, you know, over 50 million, and he's not spent it.
Well, that's the thing that's really changed for me, is the attitude of the Arsenal fans. You know, we've gone from Arsene knows to the natives of Islington being restless for the first time in a long time, it feels like. And I think that sense of restlessness has been obviously further piqued by Fabregas, about whom's departure there seems to be more sort of sadness than anger, and Nasri's, of which there seems to be more anger than sadness. But if he doesn't spend money in fairly short order, I think those protests will obviously get louder.
Is he going to?
I think he's got to, hasn't he? You know,
said that last year, and he didn't.
He didn't, surely somebody there's got to prod him and walk into his office and say, it doesn't matter if it costs you £4 or £5 million more, go out and buy a central defender. You know, I think it's reaching the point where somebody at the club is going to have to do that. But the thing has always been, particularly now that, you know, obviously there's no David Dean there now. The ownership's changed. Who's Gazidis? He's very close to. So who's there to do that?
Who's making the deals behind the scenes? I mean, Dean was very good at he was able to go around Europe. Everyone knew him. That isn't the case now. But everyone knew Arsenal.
His son's an agent as well, which always helps when you're making.
Absolutely, but everyone knew Arsenal needed to lose some fatty flesh over the summer. But you know they've gone on some sort of ridiculous diet. They're not. You know, it's almost like a dieter that doesn't eat anything now. There's just no flesh on those bones at the moment.
All right. Well, in a rather less flowery terms, they are going to be without. For the Liverpool game, Nasri, Jovinho and Song will be starting their three-game bans. We mentioned Clichy's gone. Gibbs, who got injured, hamstring injury for him during the Udinese game. His replacement, Giroud, then had to come off also with a hamstring injury. So, as you say, absolutely absolutely threadbare, the team against Liverpool. Both teams drew their opening games. Liverpool away at Emirates. Fancy their chances, do you, Barry?
Do I fancy Liverpool's chances?
Yeah.
Not particularly.
Do you not?
No.
It's interesting though, isn't it? You know, kind of Liverpool drew their first game at home, have got 1 point. Arsenal got a credible away draw, and one team supposedly in crisis, and the other's got a much more positive narrative around it. And you know, Arsenal did, Liverpool, sorry, did look really good in that first half, didn't they? But fell apart a little bit in the second.
Well, they were playing Sunderland, of course. Mm. Sean?
Well, just on that point, if Arsenal were to draw on Saturday and then lose to Manchester United the following week, the knives really will be out for Wenger. But they would have just replicated what they did last season. You know, a draw away at Newcastle, draw at home Saturday. So I think press sometimes starts to get carried away.
Yeah, but one thing's for sure, they can't afford any more injuries against Liverpool, particularly with the return leg against Udinese in the middle of next week, and then Man United to follow. Good thing this game's not being played at Anfield, though, because a ticket would cost you there 1,100% more than it would have done 20 years ago. I know this, thanks to David Conn's excellent piece there, which you can see on the Guardian's website. Fascinating piece. The cumulative inflation, this is equally fascinating, over the last 20 years has been 77%, but ticket prices on average have gone up, about 700-800% in the Premier League?
Yeah, David did more of his excellent investigative work, dug around and discovered that going to football was quite expensive. And if that doesn't win him that elusive Pulitzer. No, but it's shocking. I mean, I think he used an example, going to a Liverpool game 20 years ago, you could get in and for £3.50. Mm. And if ticket flight prices had gone in tandem with inflation, it would now cost, you know, £6.57, but instead it's rather more.
Right. For a long time, the Premier League's been able to point to sold-out stadiums and say, well, look at the demand, look, you know, this is consumer-led. And actually, just this season, you're starting to see the first signs of that softening, I think. You can buy almost on the eve of a Manchester United game, you can buy it against top opposition, you can buy a ticket on the website, which never used to be the case. The same is becoming true at Arsenal. I think once fans lose that fear factor of not being able to get in if they don't buy a season ticket, then you'll start to see, you know, that sort of 90-92% capacity figure starting to slip down, and then some clubs might start to get worried. But for years and years we've been saying, will this be the year when attendances start to dip? And they just haven't. I mean, the pulling power of the Premier League has remained remarkably strong in a recession.
Mm. Oh, of course. The football has remained entertaining. Last season, the highest scoring, I think, ever in the Premier League. And although the weekend didn't get off to the most productive in terms of goals of starts, Monday night saw Man City unleashing an exciting new weapon. A star is born, Barry. This Sergio Aguero fellow.
Yeah, I don't know where he's come from or if he's ever played before, but he's quite good.
It's brilliant, isn't it? How, you know, it appears as though he's landed from Mars, you know.
Well, you know, it's quite parochial, some of the attitudes towards football in England, and that players haven't proved themselves until they've proved themselves against Swansea at home.
Quite parochial. I mean, I think it's shocking. The number of people who I thought were informed on my Twitter timeline just, you know, going on about a guy that...
Who is this guy?
Yeah, banged in 20 goals last season, been brilliant in the Liga for the last 3, 4, 5 seasons. They've swallowed whole this Premier League mantra that is the best in the world and the greatest.
Having said that, to do it on your debut is, you know, kind of.
And when it when it's something you've heard about from abroad, but naturally you're going to follow more your domestic league. And when you see him turn out in your domestic league, it's understandable. It was an extraordinary debut.
And it was nice to have nice in a way to have some excitement around a player. You know what I mean? We get quite inured to...
I don't disagree with all that, but the fact is Sky show of 2-3 Spanish La Liga games, where, you know, he played for a team that won the Europa League / Cup the season before last. I mean, he's not like someone that's come from a different planet.
But there are, to be fair, quite a lot of people who are interested in football who don't watch Spanish football. You know, I'd take my old man, for example, likes football, watches quite a bit of it, but would never, ever watch
Spanish
football.
These were journalists I'm talking about on my timeline.
Ah, right, okay.
But what about Aguero? Is he the missing ingredient to make Man City title contenders?
Yeah, it's too early to say, really. I mean,
no, it's not, sure.
It is.
It's not.
I mean, they have a lot of strengths. And if he's apparently 2 to 3 weeks away from full fitness.
Really?
I think I like City, how they played once they brought Aguero on. They had two up front. They had Silva, who I thought was excellent, pushing on as well. And they looked a team that could do things. But
and you start to tell it all about how they can make Zeko, Silva and Aguero work together, isn't it? You know, kind of, you can think if those three start firing together, it can, you know, Zeko bringing them into the game, it could be really
quite... When Nasri comes along, I've said before, I think Torre should shift back to play alongside De Jong, put Barry on the bench, and I think you've got a really, you know, great side there.
A couple of reactions from listeners there. Compton Stand after the game saying, well, that's that then. Manchester Premier League, Chelsea to win the second division. Randino says, today's stat of the day, Man City's bench, 168 million. Swansea's entire squad, 13 million. Absurd. I know that anytime anyone brings up a salary cap similar to US sports, they get laughed at. But how about actually looking at the facts and discussing it seriously? Things were already out of whack before, but now with all this Arab oil money floating into football, it's beyond ridiculous. Owen, salary cap.
Well, the salary cap thing is a sort of perennial favourite, just, and there's several reasons why it probably wouldn't be practical. One is you'd have to introduce it across the whole of Europe, obviously, both for EU reasons and for practical reasons, because otherwise you'd get one league running away with
everything.
But it'd
be illegal, in which case,
Indeed. And I think far more sensible is to look at the things that UEFA are looking at around sort of, you know, whether you can keep a certain proportion of wages to revenue ratio, or whether you can keep a sort of financial fair play style model.
Right, and UEFA currently investigating the £400 million sponsorship of the formerly City of Manchester Stadium.
Yeah, it's not surprising. It's not surprising they're investigating it, because that's exactly what the rules are there to do.
Will anything happen, do you think, at a guess?
I think not. I think the way they structure the deal, I mean, Manchester City know full well what that rule book is. I think the way they've structured the deal will enable them to.
But this
to
was
get
exactly
it,
the kind of loophole that they said, oh, don't worry, UEFA are going to be vigilant on this, when we said, well, you could just get a sponsorship deal to kind of mask massive subsidization.
They will look at it, and they are supposed to do what's called an impact assessment test, which matches it against other similar deals. The problem is there aren't that many other similar deals to benchmark
it
against.
What about the Emirates deal?
And that will be one of the problems
they use.
It's
massively cheaper, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But the Emirates deal was probably undervalued at the time, because Arsenal needs to get money in up front to build their stadium, and also Manchester City will argue that this covers a much wider area and a big sort of, you know, development park and all the rest of it. But I think they will get away with it. The question of whether they should or not is another matter.
Yeah, right. Barry.
I was just going to ask what you made of Swansea. I was quite impressed with them. Just they outpassed every team, other Premier League team, by a considerable margin in the stats. And yeah, they look pretty good.
First half in particular, I think they looked at home. I suppose the danger is they become the latest team to be heavily patronised and sort of patted on the head, and don't they play decent football while going down?
They were a bit toothless up front, though.
The back, Vorm, very impressive, no?
Yeah, I read an interview with Brendan Rodgers in which he said he brought him in mainly because of his good footwork. He likes his teams to play the ball out from the back. And actually, they conceded a goal from doing that. Aguero's first... the goal Aguero set up for Silva on Monday night was as a result of a Swansea trying to play it out the back and getting it horribly wrong. But their goalkeeper, he was brought in because of his good footwork, but he had to make some splendid saves on Monday night with his hands as well.
4-0, like Bolton. Tied at the top of the table. They face each other this weekend, a top of the table clash, eh?
When do they start publishing league tables after one game, by the way? I mean, surely, didn't you used to wait till three?
There you go. There they are, tied on top of the table. Bolton and City this weekend. Lovely. Man United will be facing Tottenham. Just round off part one. That's a big game, isn't it?
Well, is it?
Yeah.
Spurs have not won at Old Trafford since 1989. Gary right. Lineker scored the winner. They haven't beaten Manchester United in any competition, I think, since 2001.
Mm.
So the result would appear to be a foregone conclusion. The only sort of argument you could put forward for Spurs is that they have to win sometime.
Mm.
And maybe this will be it.
They've all eyes on Manchester United's goalkeeper again, presumably.
Well, yeah, very true. Do you think there's some doubt? I think Sir Alex would...
I think he'll definitely play.
Maybe. Yeah. They didn't play last weekend because the game against Everton was postponed, Tottenham. From the kind of mood, certainly the way they're being treated in the papers, it looks like it's going to be a rough season ahead for Tottenham.
Well, there's an air of sort of restlessness there, isn't there? You know, kind of so much still up in the air regarding Modric and who he brings in as a striker and just
Adebayor,
which is making the natives slightly restless, and he'd be a huge gamble, I think. So, yeah, I think a lot of questions to be answered after what was, after all, such a feel-good season last year. It feels like a bit of a hangover kicking in this year. You know?
Right. Adebayor, huge gamble, Sean?
Not if they get him on loan. I mean, he's a flaky player, but when at his best, I think he's one of the better strikers in the Premier League. And given what they've got, I think he would be an upgrade.
Players like him tend to be sort of very malign dressing room influences, and I think no matter how good they are, I wouldn't like to have them in the dressing room, just spreading discontent and whatnot.
But I think that's the curse of modern football. I think I've heard stories about various players that say have gone to United. Now, I bet you when they're at United, you won't hear about them being malignant influences because Sir Alex Ferguson will clamp down on them. And I think it is how you manage those players that have huge egos, money to burn, and sometimes get up to naughty things outside outside football.
Mm, it's a narrow bracket of professionals you're talking about. Very good. Sean, what do your sources say about Modric?
I think he will go. I think it's very interesting that Chelsea now are making bids for Modric and for Mata, because I think they can.
And Harry's saying that the team would be better off without him.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And I would expect both to go. Well, certainly Modric to go and possibly Mata.
It feels a bit like Fabregas in the way they've let it drag on throughout the summer as being a bit of a destabilising influence. You wonder if they've been better off just doing a deal at the beginning of the summer and getting on with it. I'm not sure they'll get much more money for him, although it's interesting as well that Chelsea are now potentially offering other players into the mix, and Ben Ayoun might not be a bad replacement. He's still a good player, but spent a lot of last season injured.
Mm, as he continues his tour of London clubs. Very nice. That's it for part one. More Premier League to come a bit later on. But next up, Sid Lowe with all sorts to talk about. All right then, let's start off part two in traditional fashion, dialing up Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid, are you there?
Hello, James. Yes, I'm here. How are you?
I'm ever so well. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. A bit tired.
Oh.
What with last night's game kicking off at 11 o'clock.
Yes.
And with 3 minutes to go, I thought, I don't believe it. This is going to extra time. It's not going to finish till nearly 2 o'clock in the morning. But then, of course, Leo Messi got that late, late goal,
to
win it 3-2 with Barcelona.
Yeah. Amazing. So you just got off the train back to Madrid, is that right?
Yeah, I've just got back into Madrid. Madrid is, how do I put this? Madrid is absolutely full. It's packed. The Pope is coming. I don't know if he's coming today or tomorrow. And it's full of people with flags and special yellow T-shirts and gigantic bloody rucksacks. You don't want to get anywhere near a metro train at the moment in Madrid. It's horrific.
Anyway, Sid, it was a late game, but it was a cracking game, at least some absolutely cracking goals, and it looks like Cesc's going to fit in just fine, hey?
Yeah, it was a really good debut for him. He was actually waiting on the touchline to come on, doing his last-minute stretches and his sort of jumping up and down business, and Barcelona winning 2-1. And I think... I guess, obviously I don't know this for sure, but it to some extent is borne out by how it worked last night. I think the idea was to give him some minutes in the hope that it wouldn't matter that much, that he could have time to find his feet and so on. But as he was waiting to come on, Real Madrid scored the second, which made it 2-2 on the night, 4-4 and going into extra time. So he actually came on and had a role to play, and he did play a role as well, not just in the final goal, because it was him that played the ball into Messi before Messi's 1-2. And then he was the one that was hacked to the floor, which caused that almighty punch up at the very end.
Yeah.
I must admit, I'm, it's a bit of a disappointment, the punch-up, because they've been two really, really great games. Those four Clasicos last year really weren't, those four Clasicos in a row. They were mostly pretty awful. But these last two have been really good. Madrid have really gone for Barcelona. I think made them more uncomfortable than I've seen them for a very, very long time. And, I think it's hard not to imagine these two teams will come together again at some stage in the Champions League this year as well.
Right. Let's talk about the rough stuff at the end then, Sid. Marcelo scything down Cesc Fabregas. And then what happened?
Well, and then because, I mean, it was one of those kind of classic moments where the tackle not only is a very, very bad one, but I think just as importantly, it's a very bad one that's done just in front of the bench, right on the touchline, just in front of the benches. So you have this situation where, of course, the Barcelona bench leaps up, lots of people jump out, say, whoa, what's that all about? Then, of course, the Madrid bench jumps up and responds. A little bit of pushing and shoving happens. And, of course, at this stage, it's almost impossible to follow everything. You just cannot be sure what's going on. And so you start trying to work out who's running where, who's pushing who. And some of the things that did happen, Mesut Ozil and David Villa were both sent off. I think Villa hit Ozil, but I'm not 100% sure about that because I haven't had a chance to see the image again. And the other problem was that you then had the situation with Mourinho. Now, Mourinho came running over. And this is in a way the most striking thing about it. Mourinho didn't come running over. He walked over very calmly, so it didn't look like it was, the product of him getting wound up momentarily. Walked over very calmly, reached round the back of Tito Villanova, who is Pep Guardiola's number two, and seemed to grab him across the face. Now, if you look at the photographs, and it looks like he stuck his fingers in Tito Villanova's eyes. It was really pretty nasty. Villanova then responded by giving him a slap. You then saw José Moraes, who's Mourinho's number two, come literally sprinting off one of the benches into the melee. In the end, there were three red cards. I think there will be some more trouble off the back of this. After the game, Mourinho claimed he didn't even know who Tito Villanova was and I think very deliberately said his name wrong, because he knows who he is. And it all got pretty nasty, which is a pity because this time around these were genuinely good games, unlike last year.
Yeah, nobody found it entertaining at all. Everyone's got questions now. A couple of quick clarifications I wanted to get on that. One, you're saying that he might face some trouble from the club. Presumably there might be further disciplinary procedures against him from the league. And secondly, is there any kind of previous between Villanova and Mourinho? Why did he go off and attack him in such a cowardly fashion?
That I honestly don't know the answer to. As far as I'm aware, there's no previous. I think because Villanova was involved in the melee and Mourinho decided to take advantage of that for whatever reason. That's the strange thing about what Mourinho did and the thing that I think actually makes it so disgraceful, really, is it seemed to be entirely premeditated. It didn't seem to be provoked by anything in particular. If Mourinho weighed in and chucked a couple of punches in the heat of the moment, I think in some ways it might have been different. So I don't know the answer to that. When we talk about punishments for Mourinho, by the way, I don't think it will come from the club. Real Madrid, particularly the way things are at the moment, are to some extent in a difficult position with Mourinho where they feel they can't act against him. In fact, they've been giving him everything he wants. And in some ways, they're right to, because I think the model did need to change. He did need to be given more power. But I think there may well be some action from the Spanish Football Federation at some stage. That said, of course, they're also in a difficult position because they know that the nature of Spanish football now is that if you pick on any Real Madrid person, then, of course, everyone accuses you of being a Barcelona fan and vice versa. And it's a very difficult position for the Spanish Federation to be in. And actually, they've always had a bit of a problem with having balls and they just don't do it normally.
Sid, there was a great moment last night. I don't know if you saw it when Leo Messi went over, I think, to get the ball for a throw-in or something near the bench, and Jose Mourinho sort of waved his hand in front of his face as if he'd just been sort of smelt this overpowering stench.
Yeah, we could see that from I was very high up on that side of the Camp Nou last night, and you could see that. But what I wasn't sure was whether Mourinho had said something. There's a real trend in Spain at the moment for people, as we in fact saw last year with the Clasicos when that incident between Busquets and Marcelo happened, there seems to be this trend for people covering their mouths to make sure they can't be lip-read when they either insult someone. So from high up in the stadium, I didn't know if Mourinho was actually saying something nasty to Messi and that gesture with his hand was to try and cover his mouth. I don't know the answer to that, but certainly Mourinho on the touchline, you know, I think we all know, quite likes to wind up opposition players.
Sid, I mean, all this talk about where will this all end, you know, what is it getting a nasty edge? I mean, is it? Do you feel that it's really ratcheting up the tension between the two sets of fans, or is this purely confined to the two clubs and the camps?
No, I think the fans are very much part of this. And one of the things that's so striking is that the more extreme it gets, it feels like the more defensive the fans get, in particular Real Madrid fans, get of their club. And for example, Real Madrid fans, I think, there's certainly a generational divide. I think there is a generation of Madrid fans who are uncomfortable with some of what's going on. They're uncomfortable with some of the approach. But certainly younger Real Madrid fans, I think, do actually entirely support Mourinho. And sometimes quite aggressively so. Sometimes, you know, so when Mourinho says things, they'll say that at last here's a coach that really stands up for the club and really fights for us and you know, is throwing out truths out there, those truths, those taboos that people weren't able to say before. So yeah, I definitely think that this does take the fans with it. I mean, obviously, in a way, the most concerning thing is the impact this is going to have on the Spanish national team. And not very long ago, I was starting to come around to the idea that, OK, it was a temporary problem and it wasn't going to cause a long-term rift in the Spanish national team. I now am starting to think that this is a genuine problem for Spain, and they won't win the European Championships in the summer unless something is done about this, and very quickly.
All right. In the meantime, Sid, the strike is going ahead this weekend, yes?
It certainly looks like it at the moment. There's a meeting scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, to try and see if they can find a resolution. That would obviously be very late, even if they could. Although, in a way, I don't actually see why they couldn't play if they found a resolution then, because, of course, all the clubs have done their planning for these games. Most of the tickets are already sold. Everybody knows the kickoff times and the referees and stuff like that in the event that it goes ahead. In some ways, I think it still could. Although the word from both the players' union, the AFE, and also the league, the LFP, they're both saying that it looks very, very, very unlikely now. So it looks like there won't be week one. The strike, in theory, would encompass week two as well. But, of course, there would be another week to negotiate and to try and stop that happening, because this will have a massive knock-on effect to the fixture list in Spain, not least because in Spain they're always quite insistent on the whole round of games being played together. So it's not like they would say, OK, well, everyone's got a game in hand. If we can stick someone in this Tuesday, someone in next Wednesday, someone in the Thursday after that, they won't do that. They'll want to play all 10 games together. So it does cause a real fixture problem.
All right. Sid, hope for the best then. Fingers crossed for those crisis talks. And we'll catch up with you next week, I hope.
Cheers.
Sid Lowe in Spain. Good touch, big lad, says, serious question, has a Mourinho team ever lost with dignity?
I don't know.
Just thinking back. Can you think of any?
I mean, Mourinho's
getting worse, though.
He's a pantomime villain, and it's quite entertaining, his antics are, but I wonder how long they'll put up with that at the Bernabeu, because he keeps losing the matches that matter to Barcelona.
It's all about results, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. They'll put up with it, you know, as long as he
can poke as many people as he likes in the eye, or, you know, gesticulate or make comments about other players.
It's crossing a line, though, isn't it? Wandering up behind somebody, giving them a tweak and then scampering back safely to the...
Oh, well, I mean, if Joey Barton did it, we'd all be calling for him to be put in jail. So, yeah, it's a coward's trick.
And it also takes the focus away from what a great manager is. I mean, when he came into Chelsea, we all remember that first season where they just looked impenetrable, their defence. I think they conceded, three goals in the first 18 games. You know, he's won the treble clearly with Porto and with Inter. He's a great manager, so he doesn't need to be doing all this stuff.
And you're right, though. It does feel like feels the need to ratchet it up to top what's come before.
All right then. Now, anyway, that's Sid Lowe in Spain. A bit more Premier League now. I'd show other fixtures this weekend. The Swansea taking on Wigan. Wolves against Fulham. Norwich, Stoke. What?
Well, I was just going to interject. We've been getting a lot of stick for ignoring Wolves and for ignoring Wolves and Fulham. So
right.
Now you've mentioned them.
Okay.
We can move on.
All right, yeah. Norwich, Stoke. Tick. Everton playing QPR, whose press conference you're off to... very shortly.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Did you see the interview Everton chairman Bill Kenwright did with some fans, in which he basically seemed to admit he hasn't a clue what he's doing?
Didn't go too well for him, did it?
No.
Fair enough. He said, basically, I owe loads of money and I don't understand why. I could empathise with that.
He said he can't increase the overdraft, can't borrow any more money from the bank, and has said he had no idea what the club's operating costs are.
Well, he's the chairman. It's not his... Oh, it is. Yeah, no, it is actually. Yeah.
I mean, I think one thing on that, Moyes has not spoken to the press about this subject at all during the summer. And he basically, you know, he feels the board has hung him out to dry. And I think he's got every right to, because if you look at, you can understand Moyes' frustration. They only lost four times after defeat to Stoke on New Year's Day. They had a brilliant record against the top six. They won five, drew four, lost three. They didn't have such a good record against the lower ranked sides. And, you know, we all know they need a strike. I mean, I think that he would love to go out, and perhaps look at Bristol City and buy Maynard or a decent striker, but he hasn't got the money to do so, and you can understand his
situation. Nicky Maynard's a decent striker.
Yeah, he is. That's exactly what I said, yeah.
All right, okay.
But there's talk at the moment that they might sell Jermaine Beckford.
Mm.
But he's been paper. It feels like he's been papering over for the cracks for a long time, Moyes, isn't it? And of course, you can understand his frustration, and you can understand the fans' frustration as well. And to be fair to Kenway, you can almost understand his frustration too, because he has, to be fair to him, said for a long time, if somebody wants to come and take this club off my hands, I'd be only too happy to welcome them through the door. And there's it just feels like the club in stasis to an extent, and the fact that the money is being spent across Stanley Park can't exactly help the fans' mood, I wouldn't have thought.
No, they're hosting QPR in their season debut, having had their game postponed last weekend. Aston Villa taking on Blackburn. Chelsea are up against West Brom. Now, this was the opening fixture last season, and Chelsea romped to a 6-0 win, but a lot has changed at West Brom since then, and they look quite feisty against United.
That's right, I thought they played well against United actually, even though obviously Manchester United came out of the traps, they grew into the game and were perhaps could be slightly unfortunate not to come away with a draw. And it's a big game I think for Chelsea, because they obviously had that amazing start to the season last year when they had quite a kind fixture list. They've got quite a kind fixture list again this year, and if Vilas Boas doesn't get 3 points in this one, given the rush to judgment, people will start saying, and comparing him to last season.
Lift off for AVB this weekend, do you think?
I would think so.
All right, okay. And Barry, Sunderland host Newcastle.
Yeah, last season Sunderland got beaten 5-1 at St James's Park and drew at home in the corresponding fixture. But this year, I'd say they're overwhelming favourites because things aren't going too well for Newcastle at the moment, despite their good result against Arsenal last weekend. Alan Pardew just seems to be a company stooge. He talks a good game, but doesn't really back up what he's saying. They desperately need a left back. They need some strikers. And I think if Newcastle lose, there'll be huge pressure on him. He's asked to be judged at the end of August when the transfer window closes. But I would say that if he will be judged on Saturday afternoon if Newcastle lose.
Newcastle have won just one of their last 9 away matches, statistics show.
Well, that's true, although Sunderland have only got 11 points from the last 15 games, so both sides are hardly in.
I think the problem for Newcastle and Ashley and Pardew
you best not miss.
the incomings and outgoings were so visible. I mean, that £35 million is hanging over them, and fans are asking where on earth it's gone, and they're quite right to, I think.
Where has
it gone? Well, it's a very good question.
Okay. I'm normally quite pessimistic about Sunderland's chances of beating anybody, but I fully expect them to win this and win it quite comfortably.
All right, then. You know what? That's it for part two. Standing by on the line from Rome, we have James Horncastle with one or two things to talk about. So join us for that after this. Right. Now, before we dial up James Horncastle, Championship teams were in action midweek, and Southampton and Brighton continue their perfect start. They're up on the top of the Championship, newly promoted teams, along with Derby County. Interesting to see Sven's Leicester, though, getting done over at home for the second straight game, this time by previously pointless Bristol City. So you have to wonder if there's trouble in store there at the Walker Stadium.
And also they're playing Nottingham Forest this weekend, so reunion with Steve McLaren.
Right.
And Steve got his first league win on Tuesday, so well done to him.
No. All right then. Leeds. Barry, you want to talk about Leeds?
Well, I want to talk
about slow arousal, do you?
Ken Bates, right, who he came over all Swiss Tony the other day and said that
this was his programme.
Restoring Leeds to their former glory is a bit like making love to a beautiful woman. The rebuilding of Leeds is a bit like sex, he said. In an age of instant gratification, Leeds United is having a long, drawn-out affair with plenty of foreplay and slow arousal. So I don't know if he was alluding to the fact that he thinks they might go down or something. But just the vileness of that image coming from him.
It's just not what you want to read over your breakfast.
Horrific. But there was a protest against him on, I think, Saturday. Leeds fans want Bates out, and he referred to them as dissidents, morons, and sick pots, and then went on to make racist comments about the Chinese Olympic team, said Britain should leave the EU, called for TVs and pool tables to be taken out of prisons, called for benefits to be slashed, unmarried mothers to be put in hostels, the return of the birch and hanging, the expulsion of all illegal immigrants.
Did you make up any of that?
No, I didn't make up any of that. And this is the same Ken Bates who cares so much about his beloved Britain that he lives in Monaco.
Right.
He's just a charming, charming
And has anyone
man.
Ever heard the term sick pot before? What is a sick pot?
I don't know. It doesn't sound good.
You should see, hear what he says about The Guardian. It makes that look...
Is The Guardian still banned from Ellen
Yes, Rose? Yes.
Oh, well, good luck, Leeds fans. There you go. Let's now dial up James Horncastle in the land of crazy club owners. Italy, that is. James, are you there?
I am.
Hey.
How are you, James?
Where is there?
I am in Rome. I'm in Testaccio.
Oh!
Spiritual home of Roma and location of Claudio Ranieri's family butcher shop.
Yes. All right, then. Is that where you are, in the Ranieri butcher?
I'm not sure it exists anymore. Oh. I don't think...
Like the electric banana, eh?
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, we'll talk about more about Roma in a second, because some very exciting developments, of course, took place there over the summer. It's been a big summer in Italy. Season doesn't start until the end of the month, but there's been so many huge stories that we really ought to touch on them. First of all, wouldn't be summer without a betting scandal, and this one was a whopper.
Exactly. Who would have thought that Serie B, a championship sponsored by bwin, would have been the subject of a betting scandal? But yeah, since we last spoke, the Italian Disciplinary Commission has read out its punishments, and I think the parties involved are actually launching their appeals today. But the face of the scandal is obviously Beppe Signori, who was handed a quite severe 5-year ban for his apparent part in the scandal as the head of this Bologna-based betting ring.
I think the key word is apparent there.
Yes, yeah. Apparent, because as his private detective Ugo Vittori claimed. I think if he really were the head, then why in a case file that runs to tens and hundreds of pages is his client only mentioned in just 6 lines? Surely he'd be owed a few more pages than that. So, but everyone's been rallying around Signori, particularly Lazio supporters. I think there was a friendly against Real Sociedad earlier this month, and for 20 minutes the Cour of Honor sang his name. So after that, he was clearly moved.
Right.
He said, you know, he thanked them and said, I can today believe in a better world.
Right. Previous figures who've had their support of the Cour of Honor include Arkan, the Serbian war criminal. So it's exciting, you know, when they back you up, you know, you're on the right track. Anyway, there you go. Signori, it does look as though it was a little bit neat and tidy for them to say, oh, yeah, it was all Signori. I mean, there's no doubt he was involved in something he shouldn't have been, but to call him the ringleader is a bit strange. The figure who came out worst of all of this was the Cremonese goalkeeper, the rather unfortunate Paoloni, whose recorded activities pretty much included doping his own teammates so that they would lose a game, which they then won. And one of them then crashed his car. He was so sedated afterwards and had a very nasty accident.
Yes, indeed. And I think he has also got a 5-year ban. But I think perhaps the most hit in terms of Serie A has been Atalanta, who've obviously been promoted last season. They've been hit with a 6-point penalty. Their defender, Thomas Manfredini, has been hit with a 3-year ban. He doesn't really know what to do with his life anymore, because before he was a footballer, he was only a pizza boy. So he's been saying, well, what do I do? Do I go back to being a pizza boy? And then you have Cristiano Doni, the sort of talismanic captain of Atalanta, who has previous in this regard, being banned for three years and 6 months also. Doni is sort of the adopted son of Bergamo. He was given the keys to the city in 2008. He's the club's top scorer, all-time top scorer. And I think the president said that, you know, once he steps down, Doni would be the ideal president for Atalanta. So I think the city itself is in a state of shock, because Bergamo is a hard-working and proud town. I think outside of Milan, I think no one else declares more income per capita per tax. They're that honest. So to see their club embroiled in a betting scandal is not to their liking.
Doni defends himself, saying that all the evidence is based on wiretaps, and there's no incriminating direct evidence of him. It's just people using his name. And there does seem to be a strong element in this scandal of people claiming to know people, claiming to have contacts with people, when they're trying to get money from match fixers for putting a deal in place.
Exactly. With Paoloni, for example, he admitted to imitating players on Skype. For example, I think one of the Lecce players, Daniele Cordvia, he said that he knew him from the youth ranks at Roma and pretended to be Cordvia on Skype to convince some of the people he was dealing with that one of Lecce's games could be fixed.
Because they were paying him to act as their agent to fix games for their betting rings,
Moving on to the football, James, can I ask about Roma? Because there's one man in particular in the studio that's very excited about the Giallorossi's chances, particularly with Luis Enrique in charge. Barry, you're excited, aren't you?
Side myself.
Well, yeah, amid all the talk of match fixing, the threat of a strike, departure of sort of top players like Sanchez, Pastore and Eto'o, I guess Roma are the sort of one sort of ray of light, the one sort of hope that many people are clinging to, because they're really trying to change Italian football, change the culture by sort of importing this Barcelona model. The Roman press are calling it Barca-Roma and the Giallograna instead of the Giallorossi. And, as we've seen with the appointment of Enrique, he's largely unproven. Apart from Barcelona B, where he had unprecedented success. I mean, he took them up from the third division to the second division, got them into the playoffs, but couldn't dispute them because obviously the rules dictate that they can't play in La Liga. But he has no experience of Italian football, so they are quite sceptical. But Franco Baldini, the current general manager at England, who will take charge at Roma once the European Championship qualifiers have taken over, he said that, this is sort of philosophical decision. He wanted someone who was completely uncontaminated with Italian football to bring sort of fresh ideas.
I think they're fourth favourites for the title behind Milan, Inter, Juventus. I mean, do they realistically have a chance of winning Serie A this season?
I think if you listen to Baldini, what he says is, look, we don't want to put any pressure on. We don't want to win things straight away. It'll take time. It will take patience.
All right, James. Listen, that's fantastic. Look forward to hearing more from you. All sorts of other deals going. You mentioned Eto'o possibly on the way out. Schweinsteiger possibly coming in at Milan. The Kakata Milan story up again. All things we can touch on in future weeks. But enjoy yourselves there in Testaccio.
I will.
Yeah, and many thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
Super stuff. Thanks, James Horncastle. There you go, Barry. A full and frank Serie A disclosure there.
It was certainly full.
It certainly was.
I admire your heroic attempts to defend the indefensible at every turn, but do you ever get a bit disheartened? Did a small part of you die when you heard Pepe Signori was...
Well, obviously I was very upset. I know.
Or were you just slightly concerned your name might crop up?
That'd be a matter of time.
Obviously it was it's very sad. And the whole Calciopoli thing is possibly even more depressing. One of the problems in Italy is the kind of the poisonous atmosphere between the clubs, which means that there's always pressure, there's always tension, there's always bitterness. And I think that often gets in the way of the football being played and the kind of spirit it should be played. And this, suggesting that all the bitterness that and all the nastiness that was between Inter and Juventus is now going to be doubled. And Juve almost have a right to say that they were wrong back in 2006 when, in actual fact, they were the worst offenders and were completely breaking the law, the football law. It's only going to be worse, the atmosphere this time around. Now, that is a slightly worrying prospect. However, hope springs eternal,
They're not going to let things lie, are they? It's fair to say.
No, but on the other hand, you can see their point. Yeah. And something like this, is it better that you actually thrash it out and get it sorted once and for all? Of course they won't, will they?
No.
Anyway.
For all its shortcomings, and we do mention its shortcomings a lot, the Premier League, I don't think, has ever been embroiled in match-fixing or betting
scandals.
They're better
journalists in...
Well, I'm just wondering, are they better at organising them and less inept at organising betting scandals?
Probably all point to examples where it looks as though teams were playing sedated, couldn't we? But,
No, it is fair to say that match-fixing scandals involving betting syndicates are by no means exclusive to Serie A, and they have cropped up in all sorts of countries, both at international and club level, and I think it would be naive for fans worldwide to think that this was something that didn't affect potentially their league. Anyway, there you go. That's it for today's Football Weekly Very Extra. Many thanks to Owen Gibson.
You're welcome.
And good luck at Loftus Road later today.
Streets of West London, I'm sure things will be buzzing.
Well, exciting times there for QPR. Thanks, Sean Ingle.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry Glendinning.
You're very welcome.
Thanks as well to Sid Lowe and James Horncastle on the line, and guest producer Matt Hill. And you, the listeners, have a super weekend. We'll be back on Monday. Bye for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.